All right. I'll take come to $10,000.
Duly counted out the money.
That's $1,000 apiece for each of you.
Wait a minute. You think they can't none of us cipher? I make that over $1,600 for each of us.
I set it up, I take half.
That ain't right. We all of us took our chances when we robbed that bank. We should all of us get the same amount of money.
Tell them, Kurt.
Maybe you ain't never done nothing like this before, Yancey. But the one that gets the job set up is always the one that gets the most money.
There didn't nobody say nothing like that when I got asked to join up. And I don't intend just to stand by and get cheated like this.
Well, now look at it this way. You got $1,000 now, which you didn't have before. You know how long you'd have to cowboy to make $1,000?
I don't care. That ain't the point. I don't intend to be cheated like that.
While Yancey was talking, Dooley pulled his pistol.
Then I reckon you can't be reasoned with, can you?
What? What are you doing with that gun?
Go, Yancey.
Go? Go where?
Anywhere. I don't want you around anymore.
All right. It ain't right, but give me my money and I'll be on my way.
No money for you.
What do you mean no money for me?
$1,000 wasn't enough for you, so you get none. Now get out of here!
Yancey glared at Dooley, then he started toward his horse.
What the hell did you just do? You son of a bitch, you just killed my horse!
You're lucky I didn't kill you. Kurt, get his gun.
Kurt walked up to Yancey and pulled his pistol from his holster.
All right, Yancey, start walking.
This ain't right.
I thought we already had that settled. I decide what's right.
Even before the echo died, Yancey was running back down the trail.
Dooley, leaving him out here without a horse or gun? He could die.
Yeah, he could. Now, each one of you boys is $200 richer. That is, unless you don't want the money.
Hell, I want the money.
Me too.
I'll take my share.
Fargo, that just leaves you.
Dooley had not yet put his pistol back in its holster when a little wisp of smoke curled upward from the end of the barrel. The implication was obvious to Fargo.
Well, Yancey was a troublemaker. He was right to do what you'd done.
Yeah, I thought you might see things my way.
As the trial continued, the prosecution called witness after witness to the stand to testify as to what they saw on the morning of the robbery. In every case, the testimony was the same. They had seen two men leaving the bank. Then they'd heard Clark shout out the warning that the bank had been robbed. They talked about seeing and hearing the exchange of gunshots and seeing Mr. Clark go down. Hagen questioned a witness.
Did all of the robbers shoot at Mr. Clark?
No, sir. Just the two who come out of the bank and the one that was holding the horses in front of the bank. There was three more men across the street waiting in front of Sykes Leather Goods, but they didn't shoot at Mr. Clark.
How do you know that those three men were involved with the robbery?
Well, because they all left town together, and all of them were shooting and hollering as they rode away.
I see. But as far as to who actually shot Mr. Clark, it was the two men who were wearing red and black plaid shirts, and the one man who was wearing a white shirt. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
From your point of observation, could you tell which one of the three actually killed Mr. Clark?
No, sir, I could not.
In fact, if I told you that there were four bullets in Mr. Clark's body, would you be able to believe that all three may have had a hand in killing him?
Well, yes, I would say so.
Mr. Jensen, counsel is leading the witness. Are you not going to object?
I'm not going to object, Your Honor, because I don't care which of these three or if all three killed him. I wasn't one of the three.
Very well, I will disallow it myself. Jury will disregard counsel's last comment. You may continue, Mr. Hagen.
I'm through with this witness, Your Honor.
Did you see me in the street in front of the bank that day?
Yeah, I seen you. I seen you in that shirt.
I have no doubt that you saw the shirt, but I want you to take a look at my face closely. Is this the face of the man you saw in front of the bank?
No. You ain't the one that was standing in front of the bank. But I done told you, and everyone has done told you. The faces of the two that come out of the bank was covered by masks.
Thank you. That's all.
But I seen that shirt you was wearing.
Thank you. That is all.
Billy Frakes was Hagen's next witness. As the prosecutor had done with all the other witnesses, Hagen held up the red and black plaid shirt.
Have you seen this shirt before, Billy?
Yes, sir.
Where did you see it?
The defendant was wearing it when we found him.
Had you ever seen this shirt before?
Yes, sir.
When and where did you see it before?
I seen it on the 6th of this month. I seen it when the two men who was wearing them come riding into town. Then I seen it again when the two bank robbers come running out of the bank.
No, wait a minute. Are you saying that you saw him when he rode into town?
Yes, sir.
And this was before the robbery?
Yes, sir.
So you saw him without the mask?
Maybe.
Maybe? What do you mean, maybe?
I seen their faces, but I didn't look at them that long. I couldn't tell you if this was one of the men or not.
But you do remember the shirt, right?
Oh, yes, sir.
You saw the shirt on one of the men who came riding into town?
Yes, sir.
And you saw it again when you were with the posse as they arrested him?
Yes, sir.
No further questions. Your witness, Mr. Jensen.
Did you get a good look at the man who was standing in front of the bank? The man wearing a shirt just like that one?
Yes, sir. I got a good look at him.
Am I that man?
No, sir, you ain't that man.
Smoke turned away as if to sit down. Then, getting an idea, he stopped and turned back toward the witness.
You said you were going to try to sell a pair of boots to one of the robbers.
Yeah, I was. See, I make boots, and I figured if I could sell a few pair, well, maybe Mr. Sykes would carry them in his store. And I thought maybe one of them might buy my boots since I seen him looking at the boots in Sykes' window.
You make boots, do you?
Yes, sir.
So, you must know quite a bit about boots.
I know more than most folks do, I reckon.
Do you take notice of the kind of boots people wear?
Oh, yes, sir. I'm always looking at folks' boots.
Can you tell me what kind of boots I'm wearing?
Smoke started to stick his boot out so Frakes could see it, but Frakes waved it off.
You don't have to show me. I done looked at them. Them boots you're wearing is what's called black cherry brush-off boots. They's real nice. Kind of expensive.
Were any of the bank robbers wearing boots like these?
Are you kidding? None of them had boots like those. No, sir, they was wearing old scuffed-up boots, the kind you can buy anywhere for no more than $2.
Suddenly, the smile left Frakes' face, and he looked over at the judge.
Well, that's right. They wasn't none of them wearing boots like these here boots.
In redirect, Hagen tried to get Frakes to say that he couldn't be sure about the boots, that maybe one of them could have been wearing boots like the boots the defendant was wearing. But Frakes could not be budged.
They was all six wearing scuffed-up boots.
When the prosecution finished its case, Judge Craig invited Smoke to call any witnesses that he might have for his defense.
Your Honor, in order to call any witnesses for defense, I would have to bring some people here from Big Rock.
Could any of the people from Big Rock testify that you were somewhere else on the day of the robbery?
No, sir. They would be more on the order of character witnesses.
I see. Mr. Jensen, is there any witness anywhere who could testify that they were with you on the 6th of this month?
No, Your Honor. I was on the trail for that entire day. I didn't see a soul until I encountered the bank robbers.
If you cannot find a witness who can testify in direct contradiction to any of the witnesses the prosecution has brought to the stand, then I see no reason for granting a stay on this trial. I'll give you half an hour to compose your thoughts. Then I will expect you to make your closing arguments. This court stands in recess for 1/2 hour.
As Smoke sat back down at his table, he saw the prosecutor summon Pike over to him. Hagen and the deputy spoke for a moment, then Pike left.
Do you want me to help you with your closing argument?
No, thanks. I'm sure you mean the best, Mr. Jackson. But seeing as this is my life we're talking about here, I think I'd feel better if I did it myself.
All right.
Jackson got up and started to leave. Then he turned and looked back at Smoke.
Mr. Jensen, don't try to make a speech. Just talk to the folks in the jury as if you were telling a friend what happened.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
All too soon, it seemed, the court was back in session.
You may begin your closing argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Smoke turned to face the jury.
I must say that I'm a little surprised that nobody in this town knows me. I guess this is a little far from Big Rock, so it's out of my home area. But I am well known back home, and I'm proud to say that I'm known as a man of honesty and integrity. One of my closest friends in Big Rock is Sheriff Carson. I own a ranch there, a rather substantial ranch, and I'm what you might regard as a pillar of the community. Now, normally, it isn't my style to blow my own horn, so to speak. But since I don't have anyone over here to blow it for me, well, I reckon I don't have much choice. I did not rob the bank here. I did not kill Mr. Clark. I did not know Mr. Clark. but from some of the testimony I've heard here today, I'm sure he was a good man. I can understand how having a good man killed so senselessly could get a town upset. But wouldn't it be better for you to find the person who actually did it? I wish I could tell you that I know who did it, but I don't. I was set up by 6 men, 2 of whom were wearing shirts identical to the one prosecution is using as his evidence. While I was distracted, one of them knocked me out, and when I came to, I saw that my own shirt was gone, and I was wearing that shirt. I was angry that someone had stolen my shirt, and puzzled as to why they would do it. But when Marshal Turnbull and his posse came along a little later, I learned the reason. One of the bank robbers, perhaps even the killer, put his shirt on me to throw suspicion my way. Now, before you vote on your verdict, I want you to think about 2 things. 1, nobody saw the face of the 2nd man who was wearing the plaid shirt. And 2, we heard Mr. Frakes say that not one of the 6 was wearing boots like these.
Satisfied that he had done his best, Smoke sat down. Just as he did so, he saw Pike, smiling from ear to ear, come back into the schoolroom courthouse. He was carrying a bag, which he showed to Hagen. The 2 spoke about it for a moment, then looked over at Smoke.
Mr. Hagen?
Please the court, I'd like 1 minute.
Make it quick.
Hagen took the sack over to Frakes and showed it to him. Frakes looked into the bag, then nodded.
Thank you.
Hagen returned to the front of the room, faced the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, in Kirby Jensen's closing argument, you heard him say that he owned a large ranch near Big Rock. That is true. He does own a large ranch. However, according to papers found on him when he was arrested, the ranch is encumbered by a mortgage note of $2,000 due in just over 1 month. If he fails to make that payment, he will lose his ranch. That, I submit, is incentive enough to make an otherwise honest rancher rob a bank. Where is that money, you may ask? Why was it not found on him? That is a good question. And the answer is as simple and as old as the sin of thievery itself. There is no honor among thieves, and he had none of the money when he was arrested because Jensen was beaten and robbed by his own fellow thieves. Did Kirby Jensen kill Mr. Clark? There were 4 bullets found in Mr. Clark's body, so it is likely that one of those bullets was his. But according to the law, it doesn't matter whether any of those bullets came from Jensen's gun or not. According to the law, everyone who was there is equally guilty of murder. Now there comes only the question, was he there? You have heard witness after witness testify that they saw this shirt on the back of one of the killers. You also heard Billy Frakes testify that he saw the faces of the 2 men when they rode into town, and having seen the faces, cannot rule out the possibility that Kirby Jensen was among them. And not even Jensen can produce 1 witness who can testify that he was not there. So what did Jensen do? He showed Billy Frakes a pair of fancy boots and asked if any of the robbers were wearing such boots. Billy Frakes said no.
Hagen reached down into the sack and pulled out a pair of boots. Smoke felt his heart sink. He had brought along those old and worn boots, intending to wear them to keep his better boots from getting scuffed. But they were uncomfortable as riding boots, so he kept them rolled up in his blankets.
Mr. Pike took these boots from Kirby Jensen's bedroll about 30 minutes ago. You all saw me show these boots to Billy Frakes. Billy just told me that if need be, he is prepared to testify that the 2 men in the red and black plaid shirts were wearing boots exactly like these. Gentlemen of the jury, your task is solemn, but it is simple. Your task is solemn because you are charged by your fellow citizens with the responsibility of bringing justice to our fair town. But your task is simple because there is overwhelming and irrefutable evidence to help you to come to the right decision. And the right decision is to find Kirby Jensen guilty of murder in the 1st degree.
Hagen turned and started back toward his seat. The jury filed out through the back door of the schoolhouse, then gathered under a shade tree to discuss the case. They returned in less than 30 minutes.
Who is the foreman of the jury?
I am, Your Honor.
The name is Jeff Colfax.
Mr. Colfax, has the jury reached a verdict?
We reached a verdict, Your Honor.
Would you publish the verdict, please?
We, the jury, find this here fella guilty of murder and bank robbing.
So say you all?
So say we all.
Thank you, Mr. Foreman. The jury is dismissed. Mr. Turnbull, you are hereby relieved of your duty as court bailiff and may resume your duties as city marshal. Now, Marshal Turnbull, bring your prisoner before the bench to hear his sentencing.
Marshal Turnbull stepped over to the defense table and looked down at Smoke.
Stand up and hold your hands out.
Smoke did as he was directed, and Turnbull clamped the manacles on his wrist before leading him up to stand before the judge.
It is the sentence of this court that a gallows be constructed in the city street so that all may bear witness to the inevitable result that befalls a person bent on following the path of crime. Then, on Thursday next, at 10 o'clock of the morning hour, you will be removed from your jail cell and taken to this public gallows, where a noose will be placed around your neck, a lever will be thrown, a trap door will fall from under your feet, and you will be hurled into eternity. May God have mercy on your evil, vile, and worthless soul, sir, because I have none.
$100! I'll bet $100 that no man can stay on Cannonball for one whole minute.
Pearly and Cal were on their way back to Big Rock, but they'd stopped in the town of Jasper. They were having a quiet beer together in the Good Nature Saloon when they heard the offer.
That ain't much of a bet, Stacy. Hell, there ain't nobody ever stayed on him for more than 10 seconds. Can nobody stay on him for a full minute?
I'll try it, if you give odds.
What kind of odds?
2 to 1. I'll put up 20. If I can stay on for a whole minute, you'll pay me 40.
You got $20, cowboy?
I got 20.
All right. Put up the $20. Let's see what you can do.
Everyone poured out of the saloon to see the man ride.
Come on, Cal. Let's go see this.
Now, there had been no more than 20 men in that saloon when the challenge was issued. But as they started down the street toward the corral, word spread through the rest of the town so that many more joined. By the time they reached the corral, which was at the far end of the street from the Good Nature Saloon, there were nearly 100 spectators. Pearly and Cal found a seat on the top rail of the corral fence and watched as they saddled Cannonball. Cannonball was a big horse with a well-defined musculature. He was also a very aggressive horse, fighting against even being saddled. When at last they got the saddle on Cannonball, Pete climbed up on the top rung of the fence and crouched there, ready. Pete nodded toward the two men who were handling Cannonball, and they led the horse over. Pete pounced on the horse's back, and the two handlers let go and jumped out of the way. Cannonball exploded away from the fence, then went through a series of gyrations, bucking, twisting, coming down stiff-legged, ducking his head. Pete was thrown in less than 10 seconds.
You think you could ride him, Cal?
Yeah, I think I could ride him.
You think you could $100 worth?
Huh, are you kidding? I don't have $100.
Well, I do. I'll give it to you to bet, if you think you could ride him.
No, Pearly, that's your money. That's money you said you were going to give to Smoke and Miss Sally.
Yes, it is. But if you could win $200 more, don't you think that would be even better?
Yeah, well, sure, but I...
Do you think you can ride him, or don't you?
Yeah, I think I can ride him.
The two wranglers grabbed Cannonball and brought him back to the end of the corral.
Anybody else?
Nobody responded.
This is your last chance, boys. Anybody else want to try before we put Cannonball back in his stall?
There was still no answer.
All right, man, get the saddle off of him.
Here, Cal, here's the money.
I'll have a go at it for $100.
What did you say?
Cal held up the $100 that Pearly had given him.
I said I would ride him. And I'm betting $100 that I can stay on him an entire minute.
Where did you get $100?
What difference does it make where I got it? You didn't ask anybody else where they got the money.
And you want to wager that $100 that you can stay on Cannonball for a minute?
Yes, sir.
That's one whole minute, mind you, not 59 seconds.
an entire minute.
All right, I'll bet you $100. What do you mean, huh? That's what you want, ain't it? You bet $100?
I am betting $100. You are betting $200.
$200 is a lot of money.
The boy's right, though, Stacy.
Pete the Cowboy was the first to try to ride Cannonball.
That's what you said? You said you was giving 2-1. If the boy bets 100 and he stays on the horse for a whole minute, you give him 200.
All right, it don't matter none. There ain't no way this boy or anyone could stay on Cannonball for a whole minute.
Cal gave the $100 back to Pearlie.
Hold on to it.
Well, get over here and do it.
Cal walked down to the other end of the corral, climbed up on the fence, then dropped down on the Cannonball's back. Cannonball leaped away from the fence, throwing Cal into the air as he did so. Then Cal did an amazing thing. Instead of coming back down on the saddle, he came back on the horse's hindquarters just behind the saddle. He held on as the saddle slipped off. Then he moved forward and riding bareback, he stayed with the animal. The horse tried every maneuver to throw Cal off. He porpoised and sunfished. He twisted and turned. He reared on his hind legs and then he jumped up on his forelegs. He dipped his head and leaned, a maneuver that had worked with all the previous riders. Cal countered that move just as he told Pearlie he said he would, by jerking the horse's head back and kneeing him in the neck on the opposite side. Cannonball ran full speed to the far end of the street and came to a sliding stop. Cal stayed on his back. Everyone watched as the horse and rider remained motionless at the far end of the street. And Cal turned Cannonball around and they walked back up to the corral at a leisurely pace. When they got back, Cal was sitting sideways on the horse's back.
How long has it been?
1 minute and 37 seconds.
You owe me $200.
I never thought you'd be able to stay on.
Yeah. Especially after you loosened the saddle.
I did not loosen the saddle.
Then I guess you did it on your own, huh, Jerry?
Jerry looked over at Stacy and pointed.
I didn't do it on my own. Mr. Stacy, he told me to do it.
You're fired, Jerry.
No need for you to be firing me. I quit.
Jerry looked at Cal.
Sorry, fella. I ought not to have done that. I reckon I was just trying to hang on to my job.
No need to apologize. I won't be holding on to any hard feelings. I just want my money, that's all.
Stacy stared at Cal for a long moment. Then he pulled out a roll of money from his pocket and counted off $200.
Here's your damn money.
$426.
Pearlie and Cal counted their money that night.
That ain't the 2,000 Smoke needs to save the ranch.
Well, maybe it ain't, but it ain't no small potatoes either, and it might help him. If nothing else, it'll give them a little money to start with, if they have to start all over again.
Yeah?
You're all right with this, ain't you, Cal? I mean, giving our money to them and all. When you think about it, this is a lot of money to be given away like this. In fact, I don't know as I've ever had that much money on my own before.
I know I ain't.
Are you going to be able to give it up? Because if you don't, I don't think anyone would fault you.
I'm going to give it up.
Good man. Good man.
Smoke was lying on the bunk in the small, hot, and airless cell of the marshal's office. Turnbull stepped up to the cell.
Your lunch will be here in a few minutes. The jail has a deal with Emma's Cafe to furnish meals for the prisoners.
Thanks.
Oh, and I also have some paper and a pencil here. If there's anyone you'd like to write a letter to, I'll see that it gets mailed.
Any chance of sending a telegram?
Nope. The line's still down. If you want to send word out to anyone, a letter's the only way you can do it.
All right, let me have the paper and pencil.
Turnbull nodded, walked over to his desk, and got the paper and pencil, then brought them back and passed them between the bars. Smoke took them, then he returned to his bunk and sat down. He lifted the pencil to write, but didn't begin right away. He didn't want to hurry into this letter. He realized that by the time Sally got this letter, he'd be dead. Because of that, he needed to think very carefully about what he would say. His lunch came before he started riding, so Smoke ate the ham, fried potatoes, and biscuits while he contemplated what he would say to Sally. Then, with his lunch eaten, he began to write.
My dearest Sally, if you're reading this letter, it means I'm dead. That's a very harsh thing to be telling you. So maybe you should pause for a minute so you can catch your breath. I know this isn't the kind of opening sentence you would expect to read in a letter from me. And believe me, it's not one I wanted to write. But there's no other way to say it other than to come right out and say it. I also realize that some explanation is in order, so as well as I can, I'll bring you up to just what happened to me since I left home a week ago.
Smoke went on to tell Sally about all that had happened to him and the false conviction that had been handed down by the jury. As he finished writing the letter and contemplated the thought of never seeing Sally again, a single tear rolled down his cheek. When Pearlie and Cal rode into Big Rock, Pearlie pointed to a buckboard and team that was parked in front of the telegraph office.
Isn't that a rig from Sugarloaf?
Yeah. Smoke must be sending a telegram.
Let's go surprise him.
Dismounting alongside the buckboard, Pearlie and Cal stepped into the telegraph office. Rather than surprising Smoke, they were themselves surprised to see Sally there.
Hello, Miss Sally.
There was a look of concern on Sally's face when she turned, but that was replaced by a big smile the moment she saw Pearlie and Cal.
Pearlie! Cal!
Opening her arms, she embraced each of them in turn.
Oh, I am so happy to see you. I'm so glad you're back.
Where's Smoke? We got something for him.
The smile left Sally's face, to be replaced once more by a look of concern.
I don't know where he is. He's supposed to be in Denver, meeting with a land broker. He was going to send me a telegram to tell me that he had arrived safely, but I haven't heard anything.
Well, maybe the telegraph lines are down. You know, this was an awful bad winter.
The direct lines are down, but Cody was able to get a message through by relaying it through Wichita. And if I can get through to Denver that way, you know he can get through to me.
Yes, ma'am. I reckon if there was a way to send you a telegram, Smoke would figure it out. I was just trying to keep you from worrying too much, that's all.
You say you got through to Denver?
Yes. I sent a telegram to the broker asking if Smoke had arrived. I'm waiting now for the reply.
Behind them, they heard the telegraph begin clacking. The telegrapher hurried over to the instrument, sat down in front of it, grabbed the key, then sent something back.
Cody, is that my telegram?
Cody nodded, concentrating on the machine. He picked up a pencil and started recording the message on a little yellow tablet. The instrument continued for several seconds while Cody wrote. Then the machine grew silent. Once again, Cody put his hand on the key to send a message back. Then he tore the page from the tablet, stood up, and brought it over to Sally.
Have not seen Smoke Jensen. Stop. Expected him 2 days ago. Stop. Will have him send message if he arrives. Stop. Now I am beginning to get worried.
You want us to go look for him?
I don't want you to go without me, but I want to give it a couple more days. I would hate to be out looking for him and not be here to get his telegram when it comes.
All right.
Well, I take it you two are back. Shall we go home?
We're back. And guess what we brung you?
What you brung me?
What we brought you.
That's better. And it doesn't matter what you brought me. I'm just happy to see the two of you back where you belong.
$400.
What?
We brung, ladies, we brought you $400 to help you save the ranch.
Where on earth did you get? No, never mind. It does not matter where you got it. However you got it, it's your money. Please don't feel any obligation towards the Sugarloaf.
Miss Sally, you don't want to hurt our feelings, do you?
What? Well, no, of course not.
Well, then you must know that we consider Sugarloaf our home, too. I know we don't own any of it or nothing like that, but it is our home nonetheless. And like you said, this here money is our money, which means we can pretty much do with it as we please. Ain't that right?
Yes, it is your money to do with as you like. And yes, Sugarloaf certainly is your home.
Then we want to give you this money to help save it.
Thank you. I couldn't be more touched.
The next morning, after Smoke had written the letter to Sally, he climbed up on his bunk to look at the shadow against the wall. He could see the entire gallows. The instrument of execution was complete, to include the gibbet and dangling rope. The hangman's noose was already tied. Having faced death many times before, Smoke was convinced that he had come to an accommodation with it. But he was about to be hanged for something he didn't do. And there was something about that prospect that bothered him even more than the actual dying. It wasn't just that he was going to be executed, though that was bad enough. It was that those who actually were guilty were getting away with it. Smoke folded his letter and put it in the envelope Turnbull had given him. He had just finished addressing it when Deputy Pike stepped up to the cell and looked in.
Who'd you write that letter to?
I wrote it to my wife.
Your wife, huh? Is your wife a good-looking woman? I mean, being as she's going to be a widowed woman, why, just maybe I'll go meet her.
Why don't you do that?
You want me to meet your widow?
Yes. Tell her how much you enjoyed watching me die. Then I suggest you duck.
Why? Is she going to hit me with a frying pan?
No. She's more likely to shoot you with a .44.
Really?
Really.
Well, we'll just see about that.
Pike stuck his hand in through the bars of the cell.
If you'll give me your letter, I'll see to it that it gets mailed.
No thanks.
What do you mean, no thanks? Don't you want it mailed?
Not unless I'm dead.
Well, don't you be worrying none about that. You're gonna be dead a little after 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
You can mail it then.
Pike, get away from that cell and quit bothering the prisoner.
Well, I was just...
I don't care what you was just. Just get away from the cell like I told you to.
All right, Marshal. Whatever you say.
That night, Deputy Pike was on duty. As it grew dark, he lit a kerosene lantern, but the little bubble of golden light that the lantern emitted barely managed to light the office. Although the cell was contiguous to the office, very little of the light from the lantern reached it. The cell, while not totally dark, was in deep shadows. Just as the clock struck 10, Pike came over to the cell. Smoke was lying on the bunk with his hands laced behind his head. Because Pike was backlit by the lantern, Smoke could see him quite clearly. However, the dark shadows inside the cell made it more difficult for Pike to see Smoke.
Hey, Jensen! Jensen, you waking there?
I'm awake.
It's 10 o'clock. You know what that means, don't you? That means you only got 12 hours left to live.
Pike put his fist alongside his neck, representing a hangman's noose. Then he jerked his fist and tipped his head over to one side. Pike walked back into the office. He came back again at 11.
Oh, 11 hours?
Thanks so much for reminding me.
Oh, don't you worry none about that. I plan to come here every hour on the hour all night long. What's the good of hanging somebody if you can't have a little fun with it?
True to his word, Pike came back at midnight and again at 1. And each time he told Smoke the time left with particular glee. As it so happened, Smoke had a good view of the clock from his cell. So just before 2 o'clock in the morning, he climbed up to the very top of the cell and hung on with feet and hands. As he expected, Deputy Pike came to the cell just as the clock was striking 2. But because Smoke was in the shadows at the top of the cell, Pike didn't see him.
Jensen! Jensen? Where are you?
Smoke was in an awkward and uncomfortable position, and he didn't know how much longer he'd be able to hold on. He watched Pike's face as the deputy studied the inside of the cell, and he could tell that Pike was both worried and confused.
Where are you? Where the hell did you go?
Pike hurried back to get the key. Then he returned and opened the door to step inside. Smoke wasn't sure if he could have held on for another moment, but he managed to hold on until Pike was well inside the cell and clear of the door. Then Smoke dropped down behind him.
What the hell?
Pike turned around quickly to face Smoke. That was as far as he got. Before his brain had time to register what was going on, Smoke took him down with a powerful blow to the chin. Working quickly, Smoke dragged the deputy over to the bunk. Then he pulled off the deputy's stinking socks and stuffed them in his mouth to keep him from shouting the alarm after he left.
Ooh, those socks are pretty strong. Sorry about stuffing these in your mouth like this, Pike, but maybe you should think about washing your feet a little more often.
Smoke handcuffed the deputy to the bunk so he couldn't get rid of the socks. Then he closed and locked the door. By then, Pike was conscious, and he lay on the bunk glaring at Smoke with hate-filled eyes.
Deputy Pike, it's been fun. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Smoke retrieved his guns and saddlebags from the office. Then, almost as an afterthought, he took the red and black plaid shirt that had played such a role in his trial. After that, he let himself outside. The cool night breeze felt exceptionally refreshing to him, especially after several days of being cooped up in a cell. As he stepped out into the street, he saw in actuality what he had only seen in shadow before now. The gallows was rather substantial, consisting of 13 steps leading up to a platform that was about 10 by 10. He didn't go up the steps for a closer examination, but he knew there would be a trap door at the center of the platform. Gabled over the top of the platform was the gibbet, and hanging from the gibbet was the rope and noose. There was a sign in front of the gallows.
To be hung at 10 o'clock on the morning of the 15th instant for the murder of Robert Clark. Kirby Jensen, public invited.
Taking out the pencil he had used to write his unsent letter to Sally, Smoke drew a big X across the sign. Then at the bottom he added,
"Hanging canceled."
Smoke hurried down to the livery stable. Although the night was moon bright, it was very dark inside the stable where his horse was being kept. He knew that Stormy was in here because he overheard Turnbull telling someone that the town of Etna was going to sell Smoke's horse in order to pay for the expense of his trial and hanging. As he moved down through the center corridor of the stable, he could smell straw and oats, as well as the manure, urine, and flesh of a dozen or more horses. The animals were being kept in stalls on either side of the center passage, but in the darkness of the building, they were little more than large, looming, indecipherable shadows and shapes to him. He would have to depend upon Stormy to help him.
Stormy, are you in here?
Smoke found his horse with his head sticking out over the door of the stall.
Good boy. Did you miss me?
In response, Stormy nudged his nose against Smoke. Smoke saw that a saddle was draped over the side of the stall. With a silent prayer of thanks for it being so convenient to him, he picked up the saddle and put it on his horse. Then, very quietly, he opened all the other stall doors in the stable, and he let them all out. Mounting Stormy, he then rode around to the corral and opened the gate. Within minutes, he had gathered a small herd of some 30 horses, and he started moving them out of town. He kept the herd going until he was at least 2 miles away. Then he pulled his pistol and fired into the air, causing the horses to break into a gallop. The lead stallion started running in a direction that would take the herd farther away from Etna, and the others followed instinctively. Smoke was certain that after they tired of running, the herd would dissipate and the horses would probably return one at a time to the corral. But for now, they were in a panic, following the leader, and he knew it would be at least one day, hell, maybe more, before the horses got back. He was certain that this wasn't every horse in town, but it did represent a sizable number of them, enough to make the immediate raising of a posse difficult. Once Smoke escaped from jail, he knew better than to go back home to Sugarloaf or to even try to get in touch with Sally. There was no doubt in his mind but that Turnbull would have notified Sheriff Carson back in Big Rock. And while Smoke and Carson were close friends, Carson was a man of great integrity. And Smoke's presence there under these circumstances would be very difficult for him. The only way Smoke could avoid going back to jail and keeping a date with that hangman would be to find the real bank robbers and murderers. And it was that, his determination to find the real outlaws and clear his name, that drove him now. Tracking six riders on a trail that was a week old would be a task so daunting for most men that they wouldn't even try to think of doing it. But Smoke wasn't most men, and he never gave the task before him a second thought. He had learned his tracking skills from a master tutor. The classes began during his days of living in the mountains with the man called Preacher. Smoke was never as good as Preacher, but if truth be told, he was second only to Preacher, and he could follow a cold trail better than just about anyone. Returning to the place where he had encountered the bank robbers, he managed to pick up their trail. It was difficult, the trail being as old as it was, but he was helped by the fact that the robbers were trying to stay out of sight. Because of that, they avoided the main roads. That made their trail stand out. Funny thing is, if they'd stayed on the main roads, Smoke might not have been able to find them because their tracks would have been covered over or so mixed in with the other travelers that he wouldn't be able to tell which was which. But cutting a trail across fresh country the way they did led Smoke just as straight as if they had left him a map. Also, since they were isolated from the other traffic, Smoke was able to study each individual set of hoof prints. To the casual observer, all the prints would look alike, just the U shape of the horseshoes. But a closer examination showed that each set had its own peculiar identifying traits. That would be very helpful to him once they got back onto a major trail, because then he'd be able to pick out the individual prints from among the others. Tracking became even easier once he reached high country, because there was still snow on the ground, and it was almost as if they were leaving him road signs. Then, just on the other side of a large patch of snow, the riders went their separate ways. When that happened, Smoke had to choose which trail he was going to follow.
What the hell?
Marshal Turnbull came into his office the next morning and found Deputy Pike gagged and handcuffed to the bunk and locked in the cell.
Oh, shut up, you're moaning. Where are the damn keys? Oh, shut up.
Finding the keys lying on his desk, Turnbull unlocked the cell door and then pulled the socks from Pike's mouth.
Now, Deputy Pike, would you please tell me what the hell happened?
The son of a bitch got away!
I can see that, Pike. The question is, how did he get away? When I left last night, he was locked in his cell. Now I come in this morning, and what do I find? Jensen? No! I find you all trussed up like a calf to be branded. Now I want to know what happened.
He jumped me!
He jumped you?
Yes, sir.
You were outside. He was locked in the cell, and he jumped you.
Well, I wasn't exactly outside the cell when he jumped me.
Go on.
Well, you see, I come into the cell.
Pike went on to explain how he had looked in the cell and not seen the prisoner he went in to investigate. He left out the fact that he'd been harassing the prisoner every hour on the hour. Just then, the front door to the jail opened, and Sil Jones came in. Jones was the owner of the corral.
Marshal, the horses is gone.
Horses? What horses?
Your horse, my horse, just about every horse in town, they're all gone.
What the hell are you talking about? Gone? Gone where?
I don't know gone where. All I know is when they come to work this morning, the stable door was open, all the stalls was open, and the corral gate was open. They ain't one the horse left.
Jensen.
Jensen? Are ye talking about Smoke Jensen? The fellow we're going to hang this morning?
Yes, that's exactly who I mean. The fellow we was going to hang this morning. That is, we was going to hang him before Pike here just opened the door and let him go.
You let him go? What the hell did you do that for?
Shut up, Jones! You think I done it on purpose?
Well, even if he did escape, why would he steal every horse in the town?
He didn't steal them, he just ran them off. He figured it'd keep us from coming after him.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's right. Well, if he just run them off, like as not they'll all be back before the day's out.
In the meantime, that gives him a full day's head start. Damn you, Pike!
Turnbull started for the front door.
Where you going?
To the telegraph office. Has to be some way to get a message out.
Yes, we've got a line through to Omaha. Just got put back up yesterday.
Could you send a message to the sheriff in Hinsdale County through Omaha?
Well, if they're connected to anyone, I suppose we can. We could go through Omaha to Wichita to Denver.
I don't need you to build the telegraph line for me, Cornette. Just send the message.
All right, what's the message?
I'll write it out for you. Actually, two messages. One to the sheriff of Hinsdale County and one to Big Rock down in Rio Grande County.
Half an hour later, just after Turnbull got through explaining to a disappointed crowd that there was not going to be any hanging today, Cornette came into his office with a message.
We heard back from the sheriff of Hinsdale County.
Cornette handed the message to Turnbull. Turnbull read it, then he shook his head.
What have we gotten ourselves into?
What is it?
Without a word, Turnbull handed Pike the telegram.
Any reward poster on Kirby Jensen, as may exist, has long been rescinded. Stop. Kirby Jensen is one of the leading citizens of the state. Stop. It is highly unlikely that Jensen will participate in a bank robbery. Stop. Expect investigation from State Attorney General Office. Stop. Governor Pitkin personally interested in case. Stop.
Cody Mitchell, the Western Union operator in Big Rock, Colorado, was sweeping the floor of his office when the instrument began clacking to get his attention. Putting the broom aside, he moved over to the table, sat down, and responded that he was ready to receive. When the message finished coming over the wires, he immediately sent a boy out to the sugar loaf. That message was something he knew Sally would want to hear right away. An hour after the message was delivered, Sally, Pearlie, and Cal were in Sheriff Carson's office.
You didn't have to come into town, Miss Sally. I was going to come out to see you.
What is all this about, Sheriff?
All I can tell you is what I heard from the marshal up in Etna. He said that they arrested Smoke for murder and bank robbery, and they tried him and found him guilty. He was supposed to hang this morning, but he got away.
Thank God.
Yes, well, he did get away. But it's my understanding that Marshal Turnbull has sent word out all over the West saying Smoke is a wanted man.
Sheriff, you know there is no way Smoke would hold up a bank or murder someone. How could a fair jury find him guilty of such a thing?
I reckon they don't know him like we do. Sally, they want me to arrest him if he comes back. I'm legally and morally bound to do it. So if he comes to the ranch first, you tell him just keep on going, not to come into town.
Don't worry, Sheriff. I don't think Smoke will come back until he has this mess all cleared up.